Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we take a look at the cultural significance of Twinkies. We find out about a project that's helping preserve wax cylinders, hear from a student who spent her spring break in New Orleans helping clean up, and we profile Arcola's Lawn Rangers. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Summer will be here before long, and that means small-town festivals and parades. If you find yourself in Arcola for their Broomcorn Festival, you will no doubt run into a strange group of men pushing lawnmowers and throwing brooms. They call themselves the Lawn Rangers. From WILL-TV's program Prairie Fire, here's host Allison Davis Wood with more.
In the 1950s, one television show brought heroic tales of Western adventure into America's living rooms.
The Lone Ranger.
Played by Illinois-born actor Clayton Moore, the Lone Ranger personified the frontier spirit of the Old West, and his daring acts of bravery thrilled and inspired young and old alike. Although it's been years since that masked man rode off into the sunset, he's still the inspiration behind a very different collection of masked men in Arcola, Illinois. They call themselves the Lawn Rangers. If you've never heard of them, which would be surprising considering they're world famous after all, the Lawn Rangers are Arcola's elite lawnmower marching drill team. For over 25 years, the Lawn Rangers have been marching with their decorated lawnmowers and show brooms in parades across the country. The Rangers got their start in 1981 when a group of 13 Arcola residents decided that instead of heckling the annual Arcola Broomcorn Festival parade, they'd join in. That year's parade grand marshal was none other than the original Lone Ranger himself, Clayton Moore. So it was only natural for the want-to-be marchers to look to him for inspiration. Lawn Ranger co-founder Pat Monahan explains.
25 years ago, Clayton Moore was in Arcola as our parade marshal. We decided we wanted to be in the parade. We picked the name Lawn Rangers to honor him. We matched our talent inventory with something we could do. Pushing mowers and twirling brooms was the best we could come up with. We've been able to master that basic maneuver, far exceed any other of these imitation practice groups around, and we continue to knock them dead all across the country.
Their appearance at the 2005 Arcola Broomcorn Festival marked the 196th parade that the Lawn Rangers have marched in. Since beginning with just 13 members, over 1,000 people have marched as Rangers. Their ranks have included teenagers, 80-somethings, local government officials, famous writers, and even people from other countries.
We've been to the Holiday Bowl in San Diego, Illinois State Fair. The greatest parade we do is the Arcola Parade. Most of the times we go on the road, we have 25 or 30 Rangers, but we'll have over 100 Rangers here today just because the Broomcorn Festival draws people in. People with a good sense of humor want to march with us.
That's the beer, I think. And the fellowship.
It's fun to watch, but it's more fun to participate, and that's what got us really going.
You got a real picture?
I think in one word, fun-loving describes the type of person that will join the Lawn Rangers. And you get a little show business in your blood.
They're pretty neat. We like to watch them every year.
You like that, baby? There's plenty more where that came from, yeah!
I was one of the original 13. It's on to the next generation in my family and in his family, so it's an ongoing thing. The tradition continues.
I don't know if you guys know, but we're professionals. Don't try this stuff at home.
reaction from the crowd. You know, the more stupid you act, the better they react to you. With the Lone Rangers, if you can get a laugh, any way you can get people to laugh, that's the main idea behind the whole thing.
I'm the official photographer. I've been doing it for 25 years. I took the very first Ranger picture. I retired from the USI plant in Tuscola 20-some years ago, and I'm just trying to keep in shape and feel good about being friendly with all these guys.
It gets longer every time, even though they don't change the start and finish point. It's fun. It's a fun group. Everybody's got some pretty good humor or they wouldn't be here. And we just enjoy one another. And everybody comes up with something new that kind of keeps the life and the party going.
And a man is known by his lawnmower. Grass that they see. Half of everybody in the crowd's got a lawnmower bigger than me.
There's no connotation. It's just sheep, okay? I'm not trying to make anything out of it.
I think their motto fits them really perfectly.
You're only young once, but you can always be immature.
There, I know for my husband, it's always immature. Oh, they're great. They're great. We look forward to them every year. They're just lucky.
Prior to marching in their first parade, rookie Rangers must go through a rigorous pre-parade boot camp. When their training is complete, which is usually about 10 minutes later, they will have mastered signature moves such as walk the dog and the cross and toss. And just as the Lone Ranger had to battle murderers, cattle rustlers, claim jumpers, and the other riffraff of the Old West, the Lawn Rangers have their own rivals to contend with, the Shriners.
Credit in the Shriners. We have no redeeming values. We march for beer and candy. I don't know what they do. They run around in them go-karts.
No whiners, we ain't no Shriners. This broom was made for you and me.
This broom. While the rest of us may never fully understand the inner workings of these magnificent lawnmower marshals, one thing is clear. The streets of Arcola wouldn't be the same without them.
This broom was made for you and me.
That feature on Arcola's Lawn Rangers comes from the program Prairie Fire, hosted by Allison Davis Wood. The show airs on WILL-TV Thursdays at 7:30 p.m. This is Sidetrack. As New Orleans prepares for the next storm season, many areas are still picking up the pieces left by Hurricane Katrina. Northern Illinois University student Jenna Wright was one of nine volunteers from a church in DeKalb who spent their spring break in St. Bernard Parish. They were there to help the residents clean up the mess nearly 7 months after the disaster.
Our job was debris removal from homes that hadn't been touched since Hurricane Katrina, houses that had been submerged from floor to ceiling more than a half a year ago. Soon, the physical work was matched by an emotional strain as we realized just how hard it would be to help a neighborhood look to the future while still dealing with the devastation of the past. Our group of nine volunteers arrived in the heart of St. Bernard Parish, armored in hard hats, work gloves, and face masks. AmeriCorps member Grant Webster helped us get started in one of three homes we were assigned to clear out by the end of the week.
Well, we go in there, we first survey the house, make sure it's safe. Secondly, we start pulling out the big debris by hand, such as furniture, any kind of TVs, any kind of the big stuff. Once you get the big stuff out, you try to take the carpet out, because the carpet can aid in shoveling once you get it out. You want to go with, then you start tearing down the walls, which is the best part. Everybody loves pushing down walls. And then after that, you try to clean up with a shovel and start doing just regular old cleaning, nitpicky stuff. And after that, you're done.
But the freedom of ripping down walls and breaking out windows didn't last long.
Usually, I was coming out here kind of, don't want to say this in a bad way, but it's fun. It's fun to destroy a house. It's fun because you live in a house, you want to destroy it, have some fun. But it hits you home when the owner's there and you realize this is somebody's house. These are people's belongings. Some people have been in these houses for 20 years, and you're pulling their stuff out. And the homeowner will cry, there'll be tears. Some of them just want closure for the thing.
Closets packed with damp and moldy clothes, pantries of rotten food, photo albums full of ruined memories. These were the things we shoveled out of each home. And even though volunteer Steve Lamb found the work exhausting, he feels it's a step in the right direction for those still hurting from their loss.
I'm sure they're gonna be very sad, but again, I'm sure they're gonna be very relieved that they don't have to themselves do all that work, and they can start over, start from scratch, and start a new life with their soon-to-be new home.
One day, when we had finished a home, we saw the owner standing on her porch, staring at the small pile of mementos we had salvaged. It was a paltry stack containing a waterlogged flute, a few pictures, and washed-out letters. Everything else that had once been in Jackie Evans' home was now a heap spilling into the street. Looking back to the skeleton of her house, Evans says she's finally ready to face what she's been fearing for so long.
I think that's a wonderful thing y'all doing. Because really, I didn't go in my house when it was like that. I got to the front door and I said, no, and I just go home and cry.
Across the street, an RV is parked on the front lawn. Kenny Forsythe and his wife Joni have called it home ever since they came back after Katrina. Besides losing his home, Forsythe says everything else he used to love about the close-knit neighborhood has changed too.
When I look out my door every morning, my window, when I drink a cup of coffee, everything's different. At one time, I used to see my neighbors come outside, get their papers, and kids come out and wait for the school bus. Now, I just see homes I just totally destroyed, And, not gutted, or either all that belongings on the side of the street. And so everything's different for us, But we're coping.
Forsythe says coping has not been an easy process. But he says clearing out his home helped him finally find a sense of closure. He hopes others will do the same.
Now, people gutting home, now they need gutting of themselves. They need all these feelings then to come out. And the only way they're going to do that is, of course, they have to face the pain. It's going to hurt, but they have to face it, and grieve over it. The grieving process is over now. Now it's time to get back to work and get back to our lives. But so many of us not willing to do that because we're still numb, because we're not willing to face that pain, I've just gone through talking to people. Talking the best thing for people right now, right. Like you doing us right now. It. Inside, I'm hurting right now talking about it, but that's the best thing for us, is to talk about it. The more we talk, I thought the faster we heal.
Back at home, nearly 1,000 miles away, far from the threat of any hurricane, I still can't get rid of the images and stories that have followed me back. And while our 1 week of service must be millions of shovels away from total relief, I guess our hope is that it may mean something to those who still have nothing. I'm Jenna Wright.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. During the 19th century, Miller Grove in southern Illinois was a town hidden from outsiders. Now it's hidden by lush green forests. Archaeologists are currently working to uncover what was Miller Grove. Vicki Davenport works in heritage education and historic preservation for the Shawnee National Forest and University of Illinois Extension. She talked with Jiffy Johnson about the history of and ongoing work with Miller Grove.
Miller Grove was a settlement, a community of people who had come out of Tennessee during the 1840s that had been enslaved. For whatever reason, they were emancipated in Tennessee, and at that time you could not stay in the state if you were a free person of color. So you were forced to leave. and they came to southern Illinois.
So they just crossed the river, got just out of the state into Illinois, and then settled down.
Golconda was a major entry point for southern Illinois. And so that was a very logical place for people to enter the state. There was a ferry there. There were several different groups of people who were freed by different white owners. The only thing they had in common was a liaison with a man named Henry Sides, who himself had been a slave owner. Henry freed his slaves and came to Pope County in 1844 and bought public domain land and settled there with the freed people that had come with him. Consequently, the other families that came to Illinois were more or less sponsored. They had to pay a $1,000 bond in order to enter the state. That money was sent to Henry Sides, who went to court with the freed families and acted as their liaison, a sponsor, I guess, and a legal document was created saying that they were freed and explaining the circumstances of their freedom. The money was paid, and Henry was the person who signed as their witness.
Did the community decrease in size as people moved on to other communities, or did the people stay put, and did this community hold on to its population, its original population, through the generations?
The population began with about seven families in the 1840s, and it reached a peak of 102, 104 people in about 1900. And then it began a demise in terms of people leaving the area to find other jobs. One of the things in southern Illinois was mining that became pretty available for people as a source of employment. So some of the members left and went to Carrier Mills, which is a town not too far away that offered that possibility. People went to Evansville, Indiana, St. Louis region, Chicago. The younger generations, as it got more difficult to create a living from the farming, they did move on to other places. Some of the descendants still live in the area. There are still people that are descendants of the original folks who came here.
And you're discovering the history of Miller's Grove from its early establishment, the 1840s, through what means?
Mary McCorvey, the forest archaeologist for the Shawnee National Forest, was the person that began the archaeological investigations there. And initially these were done with what's called passport and time volunteers. In the summers, all national forests are open to visitors, volunteers, to participate in different kinds of activities like archaeological investigations. And so this was one of the ways that the work was done, because there aren't a large number of available staff people to do such an undertaking. So it began about 1997 in the summer, and they also had some graduate students from SIU who were in the archaeology program to assist, and that was how it sort of began. And it's developed in time with this partnership that has occurred to bring in younger students and expose children, younger people, to the story of Miller Grove, to help them to understand the pioneer African Americans who were a part of our history that we don't learn about in the textbooks.
And what have you learned about these pioneers that you wish people could grasp?
Well, the most significant thing that I feel is so important about this story is that it represents a story that was repeated very many other places. In lots of counties in Illinois, there were groups of people who were free people of color, but their story hasn't been told. It hasn't been included, or if it's included, it's included very, very briefly in county histories and this sort of thing. Many of the folks that were members of free communities had, for one reason or another, left that area, and that has been forgotten as part of our legacy, as part of our history. And I think that's so important, not just for children, but for everyone to understand that our history is made up of so many different people. One of the other aspects that's developed from this research is an understanding of how significant free African American communities were in assisting others that were trying to make it to freedom in terms of connections with the Underground Railroad. And this is just becoming a lot more researched and a lot more evident. a lot more recognized, that people were not only assisted by white conductors, as we have been presented with that part of the Underground Railroad history, but the
abolitionists, right, for example.
Right, the abolitionists and the Quakers and so forth, which were definitely people that were involved. But there were many free African-American people who were assisting fugitives in any way that they could. And some of the interesting things that we found about Miller Grove is that it is similar to other free African-American settlements that were on that northern border of the Ohio River, who we have been able to show were involved with Underground Railroad activities. And we know for a fact that there were anti-slavery missionaries real near Miller Grove community who were definitely involved with the abolitionist movement and had connections with helping fugitives. So we're still researching that, and we're finding some very interesting connections there.
But there must have been some friction, because we're talking about a section of Illinois that, if you actually look at the map and you follow the Mason-Dixon line across, is south. In fact, during the Civil War, there was a period of time where I think part of Illinois wanted to call itself Egypt and become another state, if you will.
This was a hostile environment. This would not have been something, if the participation was ongoing, it definitely wouldn't have been anything that there would have been any remnants of left in terms of documentation, really. It was too dangerous. This was an area settled by people from the South that, while they may not have had slaves themselves, they certainly had grown up accepting it and believing that it was entirely fine to do. So we're not talking about an area that would have been conducive for people of color to move into. They would have had to have been a fairly self-protected and insular community. And we do know that there were lots of situations where people, after 1850 and the Fugitive Slave Law, when people were forced to flee all the way to Canada because they could be taken back, and people were forced to assist people in taking people back. Sheriffs were paid $10 to turn someone over as a fugitive slave, as opposed to $5 if they didn't find them being. It would have been a very difficult job and a very intensely dangerous job. And the people that were the anti-slavery missionaries were actually run out of Pope County in 1861. Because there were a number of people that were definitely against any kind of anti-slavery information.
If I would visit Miller's Grove today, what would I find that would give me any sense of what it looked like in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 1850s?
Well, right now there isn't any physical structure left besides a cemetery that has about 100 graves in it, which is a quite large cemetery, actually. All of the structures during the time that the Forest Service came in, those structures were removed. I've been told that even some of the structures were probably used by other people, pulled away to be used as outbuildings and so forth for farms that were still in the area. These would have been log cabins initially. We might have had some frame structures later, but they initially would have been log cabins. Right now, if you came, it's just a very beautiful area of the Shawnee National Forest that's been completely taken back over by the trees. And it's a nice hilly area. We hopefully, in time, there will be a marked, guided, self-guided kind of trail there, is what the Forest Service would, in time, hopefully be able to do, so that people could visit it and could see this site and understand the story. But right now you would see an archaeological investigation going on, which doesn't really look like anything that you would expect.
So we'll have to envision it, we'll have to imagine it for the time being. But as you do sift archaeologically through the site and do try to find whatever documentation you can, what's your biggest question remaining?
My question all along has been how these people had all come together, why Henry Sides would have been the liaison, and how this... what would have changed Henry's mind and in other people's minds as well, and what brought those folks together. And the one thing that, of course, we have found most recently is that there was a connection with a church that was attended, for Henry anyway, which had a manumission society in it, which must have been some kind of force in his life. We're still not sure about that. But I think as far as more questions, we would like to be able to understand what it was like for the people at that time living there, how they did interact with the community around them, and what kinds of things occurred, and how difficult or whatever it was that they had to face, so that we could better tell their story.
That was Vicki Davenport with Heritage Education and Historic Preservation for the Shawnee National Forest and University of Illinois Extension. She spoke with Jiffy Johnson. Still to come on the program, Twinkies and what they say about American consumer culture, and wax cylinders brought into the digital age. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. Most people today are familiar with older recording media, like LPs, cassettes, 8-tracks, and 45s. But not many people know about one of the earliest forms of mechanical recording, the wax cylinder. David Soibert is trying to change that. He is the curator of the Performing Arts Collection and director of the Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Project at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The project is taking old cylinder recordings and making them available as digital files. I talked with Soibert recently and asked him first to give a little history on cylinder recordings.
Cylinders were the first recorded sound media before the introduction of the flat disc. And really, the heyday of the cylinders was really the first, the 1890s, then the first decade of the 20th century. And then in that next decade, in the teens, they started to sort of wane in popularity as the disc format really took over and became the prominent format.
How did the Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Project get started?
Well, it started because the UCSB had a substantial collection of cylinder recordings, probably around 7,000, and that's just part of a larger recorded sound archive here at the university, which numbers maybe around 190,000 discs and cylinders, mostly materials released before World War II. And when I got here, the two missions really of any library or archive is to preserve the collections for posterity and to provide public access to them so that people can use the materials.
Let's talk about the technical side of taking these old recordings and making them digital and thereby offering them up to a whole new generation of listeners and enthusiasts.
The first step that we took in terms of preserving and transferring these cylinders was to find appropriate playback equipment. The vintage equipment is what they call acoustic equipment, which meant that it didn't use electricity, didn't have speakers or anything like that. It was just played back through a horn, and it was inappropriate to play them back on vintage equipment because of the damage that can be done, and also because the sound quality is interesting, but not really, it doesn't capture all of the information that's in the grooves of these recordings. And so we've found a machine called the Archaea phone, which was developed by a French designer that plays back cylinder recordings electrically, and it plays back all varieties of them, whether from different manufacturers. You get basically an analog output, just like you would from a regular phonograph turntable or something like that. But then you can take that analog output and you can put it through an analog to digital conversion process then and create a digital sound file of the recording. And so that was the basic step that we took then to digitize the materials.
And you also did something to clean up the sound quality as well, correct?
Right. We keep an archival master file of every recording in the collection. So there's about 6,000 that we've transferred now. And then we also create what we call informally here a cleaned up file. And we feed it through some computer equipment manufactured by the Cedar Company in England that takes out the pops and the clicks and things like that. That's Cedar equipment is commonly used for a lot of restoration projects and film work and things like that. And so we did create a cleaned up file then from that. And then from that cleaned up file, then we created other files for distribution online, such as the MP3 file and the streaming QuickTime file.
So let's take a listen to one of these MP3s. This is Gondolier and Temptation Rag. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that one?
That cylinder is interesting for a couple of reasons, and it's illustrative of several things that were going on at this time. And the first is that it's a banjo recording, which, you know, you don't hear a lot of banjo records these days, but certain instruments recorded really well with the acoustic process, the acoustic recording process. And banjo is one of them, so you just had this huge proliferation of banjo recordings back then. And also, this cylinder is interesting because it was recorded by a U.S. Everlasting company, which was in Cleveland. And, you know, we think of, you know, Columbia Records and Edison Records and Victor Records, but there were all little labels, too, around the country. There were labels in Chicago, and there were labels in Cleveland and elsewhere. And U.S. Everlasting made these cylinders for a few years. And this one in particular just sounds incredible. And it's hard to say how well that'll come over on the radio. But, you know, the quality for this is a 1909 cylinder is really just astounding. And it shows just how advanced, really, that the cylinder format was at this time, which for really the first decade of the 20th century, the cylinder format actually sounded better than the disc format, which then really changed in this time and into the teens when the discs actually kind of caught up in terms of sound quality.
Now, there are certain recordings that you include in your collection that nowadays we would find, well, off color and insensitive at best and offensive at worst. And in fact, you even include a disclaimer on your website. Some of these are what you describe as dialect recordings.
Right. You know, this was a time of great immigration into the United States. And for whatever reason that ethnic humor was what people bought a lot of on record. And I think partly because this is an era before radio, it's before television. And so people got their entertainment from really their live performance, you know, going to the vaudeville show or perhaps going to a circus or something like that, but also through recorded sound. So you find a wide range of material on early sound recordings. And I think the thing that you find most commonly that you don't see a lot of today is comedy. And whether or not it's funny is a matter of individual taste, because a lot of the humor is really sort of crass ethnic humor, making fun of, African Americans, making fun of the Irish, making fun of the Dutch, making fun of the Germans. They were really equal opportunity offenders back then, and nobody was immune from being poked fun at. And it was often actually it was the group in question making, or member of that group in question making fun of themselves, and sometimes it was an outsider. But it was a very common type of sound recording, and most of them were, the ones making fun of blacks were called coon songs. Another term for that is rag songs. And so you find a huge number of these recordings in that era.
You do offer a lot of these on your website. Tell us why you've included these in the overall project.
Well, the reason we included them is we tried to give people as complete a picture of music making and recorded sound from this time period. And the time period covered by the project is really about 1895 to, say, the early 20s. And if we had left out certain genres of music, either because they were offensive or maybe the musical quality isn't very good, because there's a lot of cylinders on this that, frankly, are not very interesting to listen to. It's just, the singers are bad, the performers are bad. I mean, there's a lot of gems on here that are great. But we wanted to give people a sense of not only what types of music that people were listening to, but the quality of the performers and really the whole universe of musically what was going on in this decade, at least in terms of popular entertainment.
Well, if people want to hear these digitized versions of the old cylinders, where can they go, and what do you have there for them?
The website is cylinders.library.ucsb, as in University of California, Santa Barbara, .edu. So that's cylinders.library.ucsb.edu.
And we'll include a link on the Sidetrack webpage to your website.
And you can stream the cylinders, or you can download the WAV or the MP3 files or the WAV files if you want. We also have a historical overview of the cylinder era, so you can get an idea of what the cylinders look like. Another feature we have is we call it cylinder radio, where we've gathered together cylinders around a theme and presented them kind of as a radio show where you can tune in and listen to an hour's worth of cylinders and hopefully get an introduction to the music and performers of this time period.
That was David Soibert, curator of the Performing Arts Collection and director of the Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Project at the University of California, Santa Barbara. This is Sidetrack. Last year, Hostess Foods celebrated the 75th anniversary of their most beloved product, the Twinkie. The Twinkie's birthday bash highlighted its long lifetime of bizarre cameos in U.S. popular culture. But to Stanford students Sherry Chung and Catherine Wells, it seems the Twinkie was being worshipped, not honored. They investigated the lives of Twinkie celebrities for a surprising answer.
Every spaceman knows you just gotta have Hostess Twinkies along. Even space girls know it. You get a big delight in every bite.
The Twinkie. Minneapolis City Council candidate George Belair was accused of bribery after serving some to a group of senior citizens. Bill Clinton put one in a time capsule. And Dan White got away with murder on the argument that eating too many Twinkies was making him depressed. The Twinkie. The easily accessible, golden and creamy kids' treat seems at first glance just a bland snack. But it has received much more than its allotted 15 minutes of fame. All this Twinkie trivia has got me wondering, is the Twinkie just a Twinkie?
Now for Hostess Fruit Pies, apple and cherry
and Twinkie!
Cream filling!
Real fruit filling!
You get a big delight in every bite of Hostess Fruit Pies and Twinkies cakes!
Well, Roger Bonatti says it is just a Twinkie. Speaking from his home in Bucksport, Maine, this retired high school teacher just doesn't see any major significance.
I,
I've treated this whole Twinkie thing rather superficially. I know one should think deeply about Twinkies, but I just can't seem to muster the desire.
Interesting, coming from a man who's had a 30-year relationship with Twinkies. Well, one in particular. 32 years ago, Bonatti was teaching a chemistry class and talking about food preservatives when one precocious student asked how long a Twinkie would last.
And my response was, why don't we do an experiment? And we just put it up there and forgot about it. It was just a Twinkie up on top of the chalkboard. And then only probably once it was over 20, 25 years that it began to achieve a certain amount of notoriety.
Pretty soon, reporters from all over the world, NPR, BBC, CNN, all wanted to talk to Bonatti about this legendary Twinkie. This newfound fame was unexpected.
Surprised the heck out of me. I would have never guessed that anybody would care about an old Twinkie. I guess it is a feel-good story for some reason, you know. I can't help but laugh. It's just so foolish.
Twinkies, Twinkies, candy bars. I wonder how much they are. Okay, a little tiny bit faster now.
Foolish, maybe, but I think there must be some reason. It's still sitting in a high school office in Blue Hill, Maine, collecting dust. Why won't he just throw it away? I talked with reporter Debbie Snook, who's written on the subject, and she suggests that the mystery of the product is what's so intriguing.
You know, people used to make fun of how long a shelf life it might have. I think I heard in here that it's derived from the cotton plant. And that there's a little plaster of Paris-related material that's in there to help it keep its shape. Do we really want to eat this stuff that isn't going to break down, that might not be real?
Snook says there's an element of mystery, of myth, in examining cultural products.
I think we all like to feel like we're part of uncovering some truth, and so why not for a snack food?
Roger Bonatti is not the only person who's experimented with the unnatural properties of Twinkies. In 2000, two Rice University undergrads, bored during finals week, conducted a series of bizarre experiments. Dropping Twinkies off roofs, prodding them, and electrocuting them, they tried to determine their conductivity, their resilience, even their intelligence. While on the surface these experiments were basically a joke, they show us one way to deal with our estrangement from the production of prepackaged items.
Well, let's say this Twinkie represents the normal amount of psychokinetic energy in the New York area. According to this morning's sample, it would be a Twinkie 35 feet long, weighing approximately 600 pounds.
That's a big Twinkie.
I met with Stanford professor Hilton Obensinger in his cozy office. He talks kind of like his desk looks, with that cluttered organization worthy of someone who's already published 6 books on American history, literature, and popular culture. He told me these experiments and legends are an integral part of consumer culture.
Living in a consumer society, the need for myth continues. It doesn't go away. It does become a form of resistance as well as a form of accommodation in various ways to reality. So all of the urban tales revolve around that.
It's true. Didn't we all wonder about the mystery meat every Friday in the middle school cafeteria? What about the rumor that Jell-O is made out of cow hooves? For an additional opinion, I turned to Karl Marx. Marx's theory of commodity fetishism suggests this sort of myth arises because of the capitalist system of production. We become alienated from the social aspects of production, and that leads us to invent stories or conduct research on where and how commodities like Twinkies are created. We tend to associate myths with ancient religions, but their modern incarnation continues today in the form of urban legends. Author Del DeShant, who has presented at the National Conference on Ethics and Popular Culture, argues that these modern myths are a testament to consumerism as its own postmodern religion. DeShunt studies things like apocalypticism and cosmological naturalism, so I approach his theory cautiously. His book argues that consumerism organizes society much like religion used to. Now, I'm not so sure it's the new religion, but part of that theory makes sense. Think about it. Many of us Americans are very religious. We go to church every week or say a prayer every night. But how much more frequent are our daily commodity purchases? Gum, cigarettes, gas, bottled water? From the heart of America, one man has turned a daily purchase into a lifelong devotion to the Twinkie.
He is the Twinkie King, you know.
Lewis Browning has eaten one every day for the last 65 years.
I used to pick up milk off the farm and haul to the dairy, you know. My route was a long route, and so I'd stop at a little old store along my route and buy a Twinkie or a cupcake. It was hard to eat the cupcakes with that icing on the top, you know. I had it all over me by the time I got into the dairy. So I just switched and stayed to all Twinkies from then on.
For over 50 years, Browning's Twinkie habit was just a personal quirk. But in 1996, Hostess discovered him, and he has not been able to live down his fame since. He was even a guest on the Jay Leno show.
It was kind of funny at first, but I've got used to it. Everybody in town here calls me the Twinkie King. I got a big plaque up here that Hostess made for me with announcing I was the Twinkie King. I've talked to the president of Hostess about three or four times. He's called me and congratulated me and everything.
For Browning, this daily ritual seems to line up with the routines he has in his everyday life.
I'm religious myself. I go to church every Sunday and through the week most of the time.
Think about your own daily rituals. Is it a Starbucks mocha? Your favorite pair of Gap jeans? Is it your iPod on the way to class? Myth, ritual, parts of DeShunt's theory were starting to make more sense. The classroom Twinkie seems like it became an almost sacred object. Students still gather around, stare, and ask, "Can I touch it?" And the Twinkie King won't stray from his Twinkie-a-day ritual, even though it doesn't exactly keep the doctor away. A few years back, he asked for special permission to have a Twinkie while he was in the ICU. I wondered how else this so-called religion of consumerism lines up with more traditional religions. So I called up photographer Tom Altany, a member of the American Society of Media Photographers. Last year, he chaired a photography exhibition displaying unusual uses of Twinkies. The annual show, held last year in a small college hall, featured creative reinterpretations of famous works of art. One photo, called "When the Twinkie Is Gone," displayed images of leftover Twinkie goo after the cakes were taken out of their packaging. Some visitors to the exhibit even claimed they could see the shroud of Turin left in the residue. Tom's own piece, though, called "The Last Snack," was the most interesting. What he did was recreate Da Vinci's "The Last Supper," using Hostess snacks as the disciples' heads. Judas, the traitor, was a little Debbie, and Jesus, naturally, a Twinkie.
I didn't just take these snack cakes and sit them at a table. I created people all of them, put eyes and mouths and everything on them. Some of them even have ears. I put a lot of attention into making sure that the image itself was a clear representation of Da Vinci's.
Tom and the other artists took a homogenized, mass-produced item and spun it in their own way, personalized it. But why did Tom choose The Last Supper?
I was baptized Catholic and all that, and went to 15 years of Catholic schooling.
Tom took the Catholic catechism and infused it with his own capitalist love of the product. If we want to believe a little Duchamp, consumerism like religion, and a little Marx, commodity as fetish, then it seems reasonable to assume that Tom took two systems of social organization and merged them into his own personal philosophy. At this point, I think it's safe to say that the Twinkie has become a near-worshipped icon of America's secular religion. For science teacher Roger Bonatti, Twinkie King Lewis Browning, and photographer Tom Altony, their peculiar uses of Twinkies have catapulted them to fame. Bonatti's 32-year-old Twinkie still festers in his successor's high school office, a peculiar relic of mass production and consumption. 90-year-old Lewis Browning still gets a kick out of becoming a consumerist deity, and Altony created his own artistic vision out of the scraps of Catholicism and consumer culture. So maybe there is some validity to Duchamp's theory. The vice president of research and development for Hostess even assumes the title of Twinkie Guru. If consumerism functions in the same ways as religion in our society, does that change the way we think about ourselves? If older societies revolved around the institution of the church, how do these three Twinkie devotees fit into a social order based on consumerism? Stanford professor Hilton Obensinger and I started thinking about the science teacher, the photographer, and the Twinkie King, and began to piece together how Twinkies, or any consumer product, might be used to create a secular value system. I ran my eyes hungrily over the package of Twinkies I'd brought to his office, but there was work to be done.
When you live in a commodity society, then there are all kinds of meanings that are associated with things. Very often those meanings can fill in your life for real meaning.
Obensinger explained how these consumer meanings become a part of our identity. He believes that people like Bonatti, Browning, and Altony have inverted the pressures to conform that any religion, including consumerism, creates.
You know, what's really interesting is people have personal habits or goals. So it could be with anything, but if it's publicized, then it becomes part of their identity. It's in some ways a way to join the consumer process, because you can emanate meanings yourself by doing that. It's kind of, if I can make it in my own image, then it's me and mine and not them.
Take any product and you can make it a sacred object by keeping it for 30 years. You can invent an entire persona based on an eating ritual. Or you can create new icons for yourself by comparing a Twinkie to religious figures. Several centuries ago, religion as the dominant social structure helped us define ourselves. The church used to give us an easy-to-use value system: confession for the repentant, prayer for the faithful. Religion was the common ground, but you still had some wiggle room. You could choose to devote yourself to a particular saint, or work hard to rise to the rank of priest or bishop. Marketing is now just as prevalent as religion used to be, and images of Virgin Mary have been replaced in our consciousness by images of Virgin Megastore. And I'm going to drink 3 cups of Starbucks coffee in the morning long before I'll say the rosary 3 times. If marketing lays the groundwork today like religion used to, what meaning could we possibly get out of a Twinkie? Twinkie guru and spokeswoman, Teresa Cogswell.
If they, you know, if they were looking for something to snack on that was a sweet treat, that it would come to their mind as a viable option.
A viable option. Now, this doesn't sound like the rhetoric of an all-powerful marketer out to shape the minds of helpless consumers. Marxists believe that our alienation from the social production of commodities leaves us searching for ways to make them meaningful. Often, it seems like the advertising industry fills that gap of meaning. But does it really? If we do choose the Twinkie, what value are we getting?
It's not hard to eat. It's fun. It's meant to be fun. You want it to be fun. You know, the different textures have made it fun. Fun, yeah. Fun and fun, freshness, and good taste. If it wasn't fresh, the fun wouldn't matter. If it was fresh but wasn't fun, it probably wouldn't be as successful either. I think they intertwine each other.
Okay. Did you catch that? Marketing is pretty subtle these days. But I think she was saying something about fun and maybe freshness. These are the adopted meanings Hostess wants us to associate with the Twinkie. Twinkie King Lewis Browning and science teacher Roger Bonatti represent two ways we can take these advertised images and shape them in our own ways. Lewis Browning takes the fun aspect of a Twinkie to an extreme, putting far more meaning into a Twinkie than Hostess ever suggested. Roger Bonatti, on the other hand, inverts the whole freshness ploy while making the Twinkie his own. And while he's at it, Bonatti manages to have a little fun with it, too.
You know, we actually have a Twinkhenge. We have this little druid shrine. And it's amazing that on the summer solstice, the sun just... it actually rises right between a Twinkie and a ring-ding and a devil dog. It's an amazing thing.
We live in a system that gives us endless options of how to create, embody, and express meaning in our lives. Consumerism gives us a lot of choices about how to define our identity. And many of us still use religion in a similar way, which leaves us quite an array of products and meanings to choose from. I can create an identity for myself by eating Twinkies just as easily as by eating blessed wafers. You can create yourself in virtually anything. And in America, individuality reigns supreme. So go ahead. Choose any product and interpret it in your own way. What's your Twinkie?
Express yourself! Express yourself!
That feature was produced by Stanford students Sherry Chung and Catherine Wells. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.